Thanks, Kate. And as Big Ben strikes 10, the polls close, we can give you the results of our exit poll. We've spoken to 14,000 people in 200 constituencies tonight, and we hope they've been telling us the truth. There it is, 10 o'clock, and we say Tony Blair is to be Prime Minister and a landslide is likely. And reaction from Sedgefield already down there on the right in the Labour Club, all applauding there, Conservative Party headquarters, rather more sombre scenes. So here are the details. Tony Blair to be Prime Minister, and this is why. Labour, 47%. The Conservatives, 29%, according to our exit poll. That would be the worst result, not just this century, but if you care to go back that far, to the Tory vote after the Great Reform Act in 1932, when they were led by the Duke of Wellington. The Liberal Democrats on 18%, pretty much what they did at the last election. Others on 6%.
Welcome to Michael and Us. I'm Will Sloan, here as always with...
Luke Savage. Hey, everyone. This one's coming to you a little late. The fault is purely mine. I was too exhausted to record on the day that Will and I had scheduled, but he rather obligingly agreed to do it today instead. So apologies for that.
Quality over quantity. That's our motto here.
Although, speaking of quantity, we've been posting extra stuff to the Patreon, and we've also had some lively discussions we've been hosting in there. So if you're a patron and aren't following the community forum, check it out. Meet with, hot singles in your area who listen to Michael and Us.
I'm not going to dwell on the quarantine too long. I think we've done too much of that.
Yeah, we don't want to inaugurate as our regular segment. How are Luke and Will doing in quarantine? I mean, I think everybody listening knows it's happening. It sucks. And, you know, we're all kind of listening to this. We're partly recording this because we'd rather not think about it.
But there is a strange sense that it seems to almost be winding down, even though the disease itself is not winding down at all.
Yeah, I mean, just I really don't want to dwell on this for too long, but I went for a walk yesterday because it was a spring day in Toronto, but almost to the point of feeling like a summer day. It was really nice, and they planted flowers in the flower beds on Bloor Street that you could smell. And I mean, if you just like looking around, either the kind of nature paths I was walking on or just the streets. I mean, this did not look like a city under any kind of, you know, quarantine or taking kind of public health measures. I mean, people were making some effort to be 6 feet away, 2 meters away from each other, whatever. But one way or another, I fear that the kind of nice weather is gonna doom this pretty soon. And also in Ontario, you know, the government is trying to kind of wind down the quarantine measures in phases. And I'm not convinced that phasing is going to work, because I worry that once, you know, you start telling people that some things are okay to do again, then it's just going to be like everything is permitted.
Everything's legal, baby. Luke, how have you been passing the time? You mentioned to me that you watched Breathless the other day.
Yeah, it was really nice to revisit it. My girlfriend hadn't seen it, and it was just up there on the shelf, and I thought that'd be fun to watch again. And actually, this morning, I was watching some of the bonus features, so I watched D.A. Pennebaker talking about it, and also Jonathan Rosenbaum has a little video essay about all of the... it's mostly about all of the references to other movies that are in the film. Which, I mean, I don't know enough about the American cinema of the preceding few decades to have really picked up on a lot of that stuff. So it was cool to see the way that Godard would evoke little things from Westerns or noir films that he liked. I know Godard's been a favorite of yours for a long time.
You know, Breathless is one of those movies that I think can calcify into classic status. One of those movies that has influenced so many other movies that it can be easy to sort of lose sight of what an atomic blast it must have been at the time. But I will say that whenever I revisit it, I am sort of shocked anew at how alive it is. I mean, one of the big novelties of it is that they were going out into the streets, not a lot of fancy lighting equipment, handheld newsreel cameras, and it just has this hustle and bustle of Paris street life. I mean, the movie really is lifestyle porn if you romanticize a certain kind of French salon, coffee shop, pseudo-intellectual lifestyle.
Well, I believe the first time I saw the film, and I talked about it with you, I said something like I'd never seen a film that has swaggered in quite the same way. And it's funny, I came at it from, I think, a rather unusual angle because, I mean, we've done a few Godard films on this podcast. We had that episode where we watched kind of some of his, I guess, late 60s films from his Marxist phase. And that's actually how I was introduced to him, you know, as somebody who I was introduced to him as someone who did these kind of very experimental, kind of abstract and extremely cerebral and political films, films that were all about breaking down the form of cinema. And I'd never quite understood why he had kind of the reputation that he did, or why he was somebody that had a sort of hipster cachet when I was in university. And then I saw Breathless and I was like, oh, okay, I get it. I watched Breathless and Vive Sa Vie, I think within a week or two of one another. And I was like, okay, I 100% get it now. These films are, I mean, whether you're kind of a cinephile or you like art films or you just like movies that, you know, are super fun and absolutely slap, those early Godard ones are pretty much unmatched.
It's funny, you had, I think, the opposite experience that, well, obviously Godard's original audience would have had, and also probably a lot of Godard's current fans have had. I mean, I think a lot of cinephiles have a certain love-hate relationship with Godard because those early movies are so exuberant and full of life, and they're also so full of movie love. You know, he was one of those French critics who was on the front lines seeing the art and the artistry and people like Hitchcock and Howard Hawks, you know, those Hollywood populist auteurs. And then all of a sudden he took this turn in the late 60s to say, well, actually, Hollywood is diseased and corrupt. We have to leave all that behind and go to some sort of a radical cinema that is anti-entertainment because everything else is decadent. And, you know, he has walked back from that extreme position to a degree in the subsequent decades. But I think there are a lot of people who felt and still feel oddly betrayed by him. There are a lot of people who I think have a chip on their shoulder about him because there's something in those early films that showed them a good time that he then snatched away. I feel like it's actually something similar to what happened with Bob Dylan in music.
Of course, the much dumber thought that I had watching the movie was perhaps prompted by Jean Seberg's rather bad French accent and the contrast between her saying New York Herald Tribune and all the sort of, you know, beautiful, elegant French that's spoken. It had been a while, I guess, since I'd watched a film in French, and it got me thinking about my own education in French, which for those not listening in Canada, you may not know, Will and I both, I mean, I guess you might have. Did you do Catholic school? Did you do core French from grade 3 onwards?
I only went to Catholic school in kindergarten. I went to public school for the rest of my upbringing. So I took French from grade 3 to grade 10, I think.
Okay, I think I went to grade 11. And I mean, I can't speak for others, but my own education in what was called core French was incredibly bad. It's something we're taught in English Canada, I suppose partly to foster kind of bicultural relations between Quebec and the rest of Canada. And I can tell you that my experience studying French in public school, if it did anything for my peers, it would have been the exact opposite, because you learn that whenever French is spoken, it's always spoken in this overly literal way in these sentences that feel a little bit off that no one would ever say, like, because the goal is actually just to, you know, teach people the conventions of a language, not actually simulate how it's spoken. So all the sentences are like, you know, where is my uncle's pencil?
Yes.
Où est le crayon de mon oncle?
Where are my uncle's pencils? Where yeah. could my uncle's pencils be? And you have to learn, you know, 10 of those.
Well, that is actually my main memory of how there were two things that I learned in core French from grade 7 to grade 11, which one was vocabulary. So you just learn, I remember the whole unit on animals where people would say things like, quel est ton animal préféré? Lucille, qu'est-ce que c'est? You know, and then Lucille would say, you know, je préfère le cheval or something. And then, you know, you'd learn about all the different animals and what the words were. And then you'd forget it, because then the next unit you'd move on and you'd learn about the difference between a livre and a cahier and all the rest of it. So that was one half of it, a vocabulary that you'd learn and be tested on and then would immediately fall into your head. And then the other half of it was grammar. And that was more like math, because it was just, here are verbs, conjugate them. And these are all, you just have to memorize the different conjugations. In all those years of studying French, I hardly ever remember being called on to speak it.
Out of curiosity, did you ever listen to the music of Greg LaRocque? Was he ever a part of your French curriculum?
Maybe. Was he one of those, like, quote unquote, Quebecois artists that they would show you and you'd be like, huh, they have weird taste in music in Quebec.
He was a guy who I think specialized in educational songs for Ontario youth. He would tour Ontario schools, and I still have some of these songs stuck in my head. I'll never be able to forget them. They were basically songs about, he would pick a subject, and then he would have every word related to that subject. So I remember he did a song about television shows. J'aime la télévision. Tu es une émission préférée. Vous aimez la télévision. And then he would have a whole verse that went, j'adore comédie. J'adore le drame aussi.
I still love some
Les
of those.
Les émissions de sport. Hey, you know.
I still have some of those songs seared into my brain. Like, years later, I've still remembered from the unit we did on snacks, which for some reason they thought was like, I don't know, that was an entire like semester. The song that went, j'aime bien ma collation, c'est bon, quelle sensation, c'est créative, c'est nutritive, c'est ma collation. Anyways, if we have any listeners in France, sorry to be butchering your language like this.
Well, I'll just say that we spent about 2 years listening to Greg LaRocque songs nonstop. He had another one about pizza that had all of the pizza toppings in it. And then finally, in grade 5, towards the end of the school year, he came and did a concert at our school. And I mean, it was like Woodstock. Better comparison, it was like a late period Rolling Stones concert, where like the whole audience knows all the lyrics. They know the lyrics better than the band does.
Yeah, but you know, by that point, it's like, are you really seeing Greg LaRocque? It's like he's sold out. He's more like a traveling roadshow at this point.
Sad but true. Speaking of bicultural relations, today we tackle the special relationship between Britain and the United Kingdom. We look at the 2010 Peter Morgan scripted drama, The Special Relationship, about Bill Clinton and Tony Blair.
Before we move on, I just want to say I think that's one of your best segues yet. Congratulations.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Good God.
They're bringing us in through the Northwest Gate.
Good morning, sir. Welcome to the White House.
Thank you.
Straight ahead, right through that door.
Mr. Blair, the new dictator of Great Britain.
Tony, please.
Bill Clinton proves his title, the comeback kid.
Tony Blair led Labour out of the wilderness and back into Downing Street.
No one briefs you about actually being in office. When things get stressful around here, I just shut that door and think, we all just gotta chill a little. Hey, why don't we have dinner one night, the four of us?
He's a visionary, true visionary.
I suppose you know the awful term, special relationship.
You think this is one of those moments?
I do, actually.
We build a global consensus around our ideas.
A new kind of politics for the new millennium.
It's thought that President Bill Clinton helped to revive the peace process in Northern Ireland.
No point being here if we don't do things, big things.
Exactly 1 week ago, we marked the 75th anniversary of VE Day, remembered first and foremost as the commemoration of the Allied victory in World War II. But 1945, that pivotal and formative year in the making of our modern world, ultimately heralded something more than just the defeat of Nazi Germany at the hands of a coalition of equal partners. The war, after all, ended in what many felt was an American victory, not only in the conflict with Germany, Italy, and Japan, but also in the implicit battle for geopolitical hegemony. Henceforth, the United States would emerge as the world's undisputed superpower, at least in the West. But if 1945 marked the inauguration of America's superpower status, it had a rather different meaning in Britain, the leading imperial power of the previous century, and until quite recently, a nation-state that had counted roughly one quarter of the global landmass in its sphere of influence. Faced with this predicament, Britain, culturally and politically, had a choice. Accept middle power status or become a junior partner in the new Washington-led imperial order. It chose the latter, bringing into being the now infamous Anglo-American partnership that gave us both the 2003 invasion of Iraq and too many atrocious cameos on The Simpsons to list. The film we watched this week, a more than competently executed bit of normie political drama, explores some of these themes in its portrayal of the so-called special relationship between Bill Clinton and Tony Blair, one characterized simultaneously by patterns of obsequious deference, rank imitation, and unspoken rivalry. To quote an old essay of Christopher Hitchens, The displacement of Britain by America as a world gendarme and guarantor was a chaotic, brutal, and dishonest process. On the British side, there were residual commitments to a continued imperial role, and on the American side, a repressed reluctance to actually seem to be seeking one. As a consequence, the history of receivership is a mixed history of improvisation, secret diplomacy, covert action, inter-establishment jealousy, and military disaster. There was, under the affectation of Anglo-American solidarity, a continuation of the old politics by other means. Elements of this mutual suspicion, though seldom stressed, endure to this day.
This is a modern party living in an age of change. It requires a modern constitution that says what we are in terms the public cannot misunderstand and the Tories cannot misrepresent.
So this week, as Will said before, we talked about the 2010 film, The Special Relationship. This is one in a, currently anyway, a trilogy of films. There may be more of them, I'm not sure, coming up about Tony Blair and his career. Tony Blair, of course, is played by Michael Sheen. And this film, though it's called The Special Relationship, is really just about the relationship between Clinton and Blair. Apparently, in earlier drafts of the film, the Blair-Bush relationship was also going to be central. But they decided that those scenes weren't as interesting, and they ultimately cut them from the film. I don't know, Will, what did you think about this one? For me, I actually quite enjoyed it as just a kind of normie political film. I thought it was very well executed, even though I had to spend, you know, 90 minutes with two absolutely awful people, Bill Clinton and Tony Blair.
As you mentioned, this is one of three films that Peter Morgan has written about Tony Blair. The most famous of them is The Queen with Helen Mirren. This is a 90-minute TV movie. A less prestigious production. It's pretty thin soup, I think. I didn't find it particularly offensive. I've seen better, I've seen worse. It's well acted by, among others, Sheen and Dennis Quaid, who plays Bill Clinton, and, you know, does a heroic job trying to make you forget that he's Dennis Quaid. I think the problem with these Peter Morgan movies is Peter Morgan is sort of the court playwright. He has these famous people standing around reciting official history at each other. None of the dialogue sounds natural. It sounds like they read it on Wikipedia. And also, the thing I'm most suspicious about in this movie is that it presents Tony Blair as this almost naive, like he's this guy who got into politics with the best of intentions. And, you know, it's almost as if Clinton and Bush are these big brother figures or these daddy figures that he keeps wanting to please. And he seems constantly being shocked by the realities of politics. You're more immersed in Tony Blair arcana than I am. How accurate a representation would you say this is of him?
Sheen, I think, has clearly thought a lot about how he wants to portray Blair. And I think in terms of his, physical appearance, he certainly looks a lot like him in these movies. I also think there's a lot about the character of, you know, who Tony Blair is that he's clearly thought about and that he does a good job in portraying. Superficially, there are things that he doesn't quite capture. I don't think he has the cadence of Tony Blair's voice down quite. But I do think that his interpretation of Blair is a pretty compelling one. And it's one that he has he's clearly put some thought into. I don't think it's possible to really discuss this movie or Sheen's performance without talking a little bit more about Tony Blair and who he is, because he really is the protagonist in this movie. These are, after all, you know, Blair films, not Clinton Blair films. As I understand, I haven't seen The Queen, but I have seen, is it called The Duel?
Yeah.
The Rivalry, the first one, which is about the, Gordon Brown, Tony Blair friendship qua rivalry. And it seems like in each of these films, Blair is kind of paired with, you know, like a frenemy. and so this film follows that same template. But basically, to just give a kind of canned history of Blair, he first stood as a Labour candidate in the early 80s in a by-election back when Michael Foote was leader. You know, it's a fact often remarked upon that not many years separate the tenure of Michael Foote, who was a very kind of old school, old Labour kind of leader, and Tony Blair, who took the reins of the Labour Party in something like 1994, 1995, after the death of John Smith, who didn't serve as Labour leader for very long. Blair stood in this by-election. It did not go very well. In fact, I think he actually lost his deposit, which you do if you don't get enough votes. But by the early 90s, Blair and Brown, kind of like the Clintonites and the DLC in the United States, were in a position to do what they called at the time modernization. this essentially meant remaking the Labour Party from a party of the old social democratic left that had run the gamut from sort of Keynesian social democracy to more radical and avowedly anti-capitalist form of socialism embodied by people like Tony Benn, to remake that into a party very much like the American Democrats. And we're so familiar with this style of politics now because it's unfortunately all around us. You know, a lot of people may not realize how deviant from the norm this was. And this happened not just in Britain and the United States, but also in Germany and a number of other countries where these kind of parties of the post-war left, often with fairly radical histories, were remade as these parties of the kind of technocratic center, or if you want, the neoliberal center left. Importantly, all of these people kind of thought of themselves as progressives, or that was the rhetoric that they used. When they said modernization, they really did believe in that. We think of this style of politics as being very cold and technocratic, because in many ways it is. But it shouldn't be overlooked that these guys were kind of militants at the time. They were an insurgent force. I mean, I'm not saying that to give them credit, but these were not blandly technocratic people. They were incredibly ideological just for things that were bad.
All of the films that we've watched about this particular turn, I'm thinking in particularly of The War Room, presented as this fresh dynamism that swept up these stale old parties.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I mean, part of what enabled that mythology to kind of flourish was that these guys came along in the 1990s. So they benefited from, I mean, I hate to always bring it up, but that kind of end of history, you know, sentiment that was sweeping through the Western world after the collapse of the Berlin Wall. And just more broadly, the feeling that liberal capitalism was triumphant and that these people, you know, neoliberalism had happened and these people kind of came along and they kind of co-opted it for what was then the center left. And so adding to this mythology was the fact that they did win elections. Clinton won election in 1992 and then again in 1996. Blair won election in 1997 in a huge Labour landslide, and then again in 2001 with a landslide very similar in terms of the seats, but millions fewer people voted, which is a fact that a lot of Blairites never seem to want to discuss. He won re-election one more time in 2005 in an election extremely tainted by the UK's participation in the Iraq War, which is something we should talk about, which strangely very close to the subject matter of the film, but not actually portrayed in the film. And so one of the things about this was that figures like Clinton and Blair, in addition to inaugurating this kind of new form of center-left politics amid all of the triumphalism of the 1990s, they also invented a style of politics that a lot of people on the, I'm very hesitant to call it the left, you know, I'll just call it, you know, the neoliberal center, whatever, have been very hesitant to break with. I mean, these two basically created the model, especially in the Anglo-American context, which a lot of their devotees to this day really believe is this formula, this kind of magical formula that allows you to win elections forever. You get a charismatic person who is populist, but only in the sense of kind of some aspects of their personality, not really a political populist. And then you attach to them a particular kind of program that apes some language and policy from the right, but doing it in language that I guess middle-class liberals in particular, you know, it resonates with them. So language about, in foreign policy, kind of humanitarian intervention rather than imperial chest beating, you put everything kind of in moral terms. You know, in domestic policy, it means saying stuff like, you know, as Blair was fond of saying, you know, we're not just tough on crime, we're smart on crime, you know, things like that. In Bill Clinton's case, of course, there's the famous, you know, the era of big government is over, et cetera, et cetera. But just before we move on to talk about the film a little more, I wanted to read a little bit from an essay called The Gnome in the Garden, Tony Blair and Britain's Heritage, by the late historian Tony Judt, whose prose I read from a few weeks ago on our Essential Paragraphs bonus episode. I think Tony Judt kind of explains Tony Blair's appeal in a British context more articulately than I could, and also puts in context what the 1990s were in Britain and why a figure like Tony Blair came to embody them. In the spring of 2001, during a BBC radio discussion of the forthcoming British general election, a young journalist voiced her frustration. "Don't you agree," she asked her fellow panelists, "that there's no real choice? Tony Blair believes in privatization, just like Mrs. Thatcher." "Not quite," replied Charles Moore, editor of the conservative Daily Telegraph. "Margaret Thatcher believed in privatization. Tony Blair just likes rich people." That is indeed so, and although Moore's witticism doesn't really address the question, it points perhaps inadvertently to something seriously amiss in England today. The English capacity simultaneously to invoke and to deny the past, to feel genuine nostalgia for a fake heritage, is, I think, unique. It amounts today to a countrywide boulderization of memory, and the remarkable alacrity with which poverty, industry, and class conflict have officially been forgotten and paved over, such that deep social difference is denied or homogenized, and even the most recent and contested past is available only in nostalgic plastic reproduction, is what makes Tony Blair credible. He is the gnome in England's Garden of Forgetting. Many British voters, when polled on the subject of their Prime Minister, claim to find him insincere and false. He is even, for some, dishonest, saying anything his hearers demand, but they accept him nonetheless, and anyway see nothing better on offer. Even away from London, there is something about Blair that rings true. He is an inauthentic leader of an inauthentic land. If this sounds harsh, look closely at Blair himself. Off camera, caught unawares, he has a nervous, haunted air. He is, after all, a gifted and intelligent politician, and he must surely have some sense of the fragility of his own and his country's condition. Whatever the rhetoric about the great prospects awaiting his new Britain, Blair knows that his fortuitous political success has only postponed the reckoning. Riding on Mrs. Thatcher's coattails, New Labour has successfully displaced the past, and England's thriving heritage industry has duly replaced it with the past. And then, it's not part of the same passage, but another thing that I really like, probably the most memorable line in the whole essay, is when Tony Judd writes that there is nothing contrived about Blair's inauthenticity. He came by it honestly. So going back to your question about Michael Sheen's performance, I really do think it has a lot to commend it, because there's always been a tension in Blair between this insane kind of almost this kind of pathological aura of confidence that he projects, and the fact that he is ideologically and personally a cipher. And I think that really comes through. And what Tony Judd says here about how when Blair was caught unawares, he often seemed very fragile and insecure, that's something that really comes through in the film.
Hello?
Yeah, you near a television?
There's going to be something in the news today you should know about.
Tapes of Lewinsky's conversations, they contain certain revelations. Duress with
this. That's enough.
Shouldn't we be thinking about taking a step back?
He's a friend.
I feel I have no option but to stand by him.
Infidelity by a president is one thing. Perjury is quite another.
The story that boomers tell themselves is that they were idealists who became pragmatists. This story is even grafted onto the history of somebody as unlikely as Hillary Clinton. You know, the fact that the recent documentary about her has all that footage of 60s protests. It seems a de rigueur part of the mythology of this generation of politicians. Do you know anything about Tony Blair's political evolution? You mentioned he suffered defeats early in his political career. Did he have any sort of pronounced ideological shift?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't think that he was never a figure of the left. I mean, there are other people who that applies to. You remember from our episode on Labour, the summer that changed everything, Neil Kinnock, whose son is a major figure in that film. I mean, Neil Kinnock was the sort of main Labour leader separating Tony Blair and Michael Foot. And he was a figure who started out on the hard left, or on as a kind of left-wing firebrand anyway, not quite the hard left, but as a committed kind of Welsh socialist politician, and basically ended up as a kind of someone, if not directly connected to the Blairite cause, somebody not particularly hostile to it. I don't think Blair had anything like that evolution. I think, as Judd says, you know, he came by his inauthenticity authentically. And it's interesting, I think you're right about the story that boomers tell, or at least kind of, you know, normie boomer culture tells itself. The kind of official narrative for people, you know, in the Anglo-American world in that generation. And one of the things Tony Blair understood, and that he was, I mean, if he had a talent, it was this, was the need to appeal to people by drawing on that narrative, but also kind of flattering them at the same time. So in the official rhetoric and kind of self-understanding of Blairism, they were carrying on the best of the Labour Party tradition. They were simultaneously breaking from the past, but they were also honoring it. So, you know, Blair, for example, when they rewrote Clause 4 of the Labour Party Constitution, I know this sounds obscure, but the Clause 4 debates were a pretty big deal in Britain. Clause 4 was the, I think, 1918 clause in the Labour Party Constitution that committed them to nationalizing, or to taking the commanding heights of the economy into public ownership. Blair, when he changed that, I mean, he got rid of the stuff about commanding heights, but he kept the phrase, Labour is a democratic socialist party and proud of it, because he was very keen to present himself merely as someone who was updating an earlier tradition rather than someone who was completely breaking from it. And I think that was a kind of ingenious political move, because it simultaneously flattered the sensibilities of people who felt like, well, we're grown-ups now and we're pragmatists and we understand the world as it is, not like our childish selves wanted it to be. But it also said to them, hey, you haven't changed. You still believe in all the same things. Tony Blair going to like kiss Rupert Murdoch's ring is just the same thing as marching against the Vietnam War or whatever the case would be. What was the line from, it's so stupid to bring it up in this context, but you remember when we watched, was it the first Austin Powers movie a while ago? And he has that line at the end where he says,
no man, what we swingers were rebelling against is uptight squares like you, whose bag was money and world domination. We were innocent, man. If we'd known the consequences of our sexual liberation, we would have done things differently, but the spirit would have remained the same. It's freedom, baby, yeah.
Face it, freedom failed.
No, man, freedom didn't fail. Right now we've got freedom and responsibility. It's a very groovy time.
We still have freedom, but we also have responsibility. And that is like Blairism in a nutshell, that Mike Myers, the Canadian actor cosplaying as a time-traveling 60s spy, perfectly sums up.
The special relationship opens shortly after the 1992 U.S. presidential election. Blair is one of a group of labor insiders who are at a workshop being hosted by a Democratic Party apparatchik who essentially outlines the theory of politics that Luke outlined earlier. Charismatic leader, rhetoric from both the right and the left. Flash forward to a couple years later, as Blair is now the leader of the opposition, heading into a general election, looking like the odds are on his side. Before he is even elected, he is invited for an official meeting at the White House with the President of the United States, Bill Clinton. When there, Bill Clinton outlines to him his vision of the future of the free world. Center-left progressive leadership in the United States, Britain, plus a whole host of other countries, potentially ending right-wing politics for a generation.
Yeah, and I love that scene where, you know, Tony Blair kind of gets off the plane in the United States and he's basically a nobody. And he's at some kind of like triangulation summer camp where there's like a Democratic strategist and, you know, unnamed guy just explaining like, you gotta be like, we care about crime, you know, give people what they want. It says something like, don't speak to people using kind of old language they don't like, you know, give people what they want. It's easier to change your party than the will of the voters. So this, I mean, of course, speaks to one of the deep assumptions of this kind of politics, which is that, or at least, I'm not sure how much they really think this, but at least publicly, they think, you know, we were just going to people where they already were. We weren't actually inventing anything. It's like, people love freedom, but they also love responsibility, you know. They're concerned about the poor, but they also want thugs to be put behind bars, you know, etc.
After these early meetings, Blair is touchingly loyal to Clinton, even as Clinton's own political fortunes begin to sour with the revelation of the Monica Lewinsky affair. Blair's proximity to Clinton increasingly seems like a liability for Blair, and yet Blair, out of loyalty to his friend, stands by him. However, relations between the men sour, as Blair advocates for a more interventionist approach to the Kosovo War, while Clinton, facing the most difficult year of his political life, resents the pressure from the UK.
And the basic dynamic between the two men throughout the movie is that, you know, for much of the movie anyway, Blair is really playing second fiddle to Clinton. In the very first scene when Blair visits the Oval Office, you know, he steps into the White House and, you know, these clueless Brits, you know, Blair and two guys playing Jonathan Powell and Alistair Campbell are kind of just in awe of the opulence of the White House and just the kind of imperial grandeur of the place from where the global superpower is managed. And then when Blair walks into Clinton's office, he finds Clinton on the phone. Clinton hasn't even taken the time to finish his phone call before inviting Blair in. I think in a way very deliberately meant to suggest Britain is the junior partner here. They have kind of subordinate status. And, you know, it's interesting that Blair, you know, the way Sheen portrays him, Blair is just quite literally a Bill Clinton fanboy. He's somebody who just kind of copies all of his moves. It very much is like a kind of little brother to big brother relationship where at first, you know, you copy everything someone does, and then later you kind of try to carve your own way in a sort of act of rebellion. And I guess for dramatic purposes, the film portrays that largely as being a result of kind of the personal chemistry or the personal relations between Clinton and Blair. Although I think it, to some extent, it can be extrapolated into kind of broader geopolitics. I mean, it's not portrayed in the film, but by the time Blair was finally ousted by Gordon Brown in, I guess, 2007. Brown, rhetorically at least, had to kind of break with the idea that the Anglo-American relationship was, you know, the most important one. I mean, he kind of course, said, you know, it will always be, you know, our most important relationship, but we also kind of have to go our own way. Blair, it's kind of hinted at in the film by, you know, a later line spoken by Clinton himself, that the new Republican president, George Bush, has come into office on scandal, on the back of scandal, and is going to leave office on the back of scandal. And of course, it was the fallout from the 2003 invasion of Iraq that, I mean, I think arguably destroyed the reputations of both George Bush and eventually Tony Blair as well.
The section on Kosovo, Blair is depicted as this principled but perhaps naive leader. And Clinton's reluctance to go along with the war is depicted as this sort of political wake-up call for Blair. Maybe not everybody's intentions are the same, not even his close friend. What do you make of this section of the film?
This is another place where I think Michael Sheen's performance is very commendable, because one of the things that's always struck me most about Blair, despite the fact that I do think in some ways he's a kind of weirdly insecure man, and if you watch clips of him, I mean, he often seems to start second-guessing himself mid-sentence and things like that. He can come across as quite fragile in some ways, but he's also somebody who, like his next great ally and friend in the White House, George W. Bush, he's somebody who's always had this incredibly simplistic and ultimately, I think, very frightening moral certitude about everything. And again, I don't know what's in Tony Blair's heart. Who knows how strongly, you know, he actually feels about things one way or another, but that was certainly what his public persona was. And if you look at the way that he sought to justify Britain's participation in the Iraq War and the war in general, because apart from Bush, I mean, Blair was its principal salesperson, it very much has that almost evangelical air. And I don't think it really came out until Blair published his own memoirs what an intensely religious person he at least purports to be. It's something he talks a lot about in his memoirs, and which does in some sense seem like it's very important to him. In the context of the narrative arc of the film, this is kind of the Blair character who's really our protagonist coming into his own. Although, I mean, maybe I'm being too sympathetic to these films. I think that they do kind of know Tony Blair is a bit of a sleaze, and that is sort of how he's portrayed. I mean, I'm not really sure he's exactly portrayed as a great leader. I guess my only complaint, which is not one that's reasonable to make of sort of normie HBO made-for-TV films, is I wish they had all the other stuff, the like positively sociopathic stuff that guys like this do. So, you know, my girlfriend who watched the film with me pointed out that when Clinton, you know, had that facility in Libya bomb that turned out to be a penicillin factory, it was basically because he'd had a fight with Hillary and she told him to, like, you know, to do so. He did it to distract from the emerging Lewinsky scandal, which is, of course, a big part of this movie. But perhaps less famously, there's the absolutely appalling case of Ricky Ray Rector, who is a severely disabled inmate that Bill Clinton decided to leave the campaign trail to go back and execute when he was governor of Arkansas for purely political reasons. So I guess, you know, would I expect to see stuff like that in a film like this? Probably not. But I think if we're going to grapple with kind of the weird certitude and self-assurance that politicians like this carry themselves with, you kind of have to, you ultimately have to consider those things as well.
I don't think these Peter Morgan movies regard Blair as a great leader, but they do seem to be sympathetic to his overall project. And they regard him as essentially a well-meaning man with some good political instincts who was unfortunately led astray.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And there's a very strange line at the end of the film that's spoken by Clinton, where Clinton says something to Blair along the lines of, it doesn't seem like you're a progressive center-left politician anymore, like if indeed you ever really were, or something like that.
Yeah,
which is a very tidy narrative of Blair. I think, unlike Clinton, is not, you know, or at least to people who like him, is not tended to be seen as somebody who or failed to live up to his potential or something like that. I mean, with Bill Clinton, the story that, you know, his fans kind of tell themselves is that if it wasn't for the Lewinsky scandal, they would have been able to do, you know, big, bold things like privatizing Social Security or whatever. And I mean, with Blair, all of his most kind of zealous devotees, they believed in the Iraq War. I mean, they really did. So it's hard to say. I suppose there probably was a faction of sort of well-meaning Guardian columnist types who thought that in the 1990s that Blairism really was going to inaugurate some kind of bold new era for the parliamentary left. You know, there's a book that I used to be very fond of by a guy called Will Hutton called The State We're In. I think it came out in about 1995. You know, it is an extremely triumphalist, I mean, quite intelligently written, kind of speculative book about this new type of politics and the new type of political economy that's going to come with it with when Labour enters office, et cetera, et cetera. Every time I've gone back to it in the last few years, it seemed kind of more and more out of date. Will Hutton, of course, guess what he thought about Jeremy Corbyn. But those kinds of people aside, I don't think Blair, like, I'm not really sure why these films feel the need to kind of, like, maybe it's just for narrative purposes, it's realism sacrificed on the altar of drama and storytelling. It's unclear to me why they feel the need to kind of try to hint that Blair was this principled, well-meaning guy who sold out or got carried away with his own ego. I don't think that's particularly accurate. Blair at his best, I mean, at his most triumphant in 1997, to me, was pretty much the same guy he was 10 years later when he left office. So I'm not really sure where that's coming from. It does remind me, we haven't done the film on the podcast, so we probably should at some point, of the way that Margaret Thatcher is portrayed in the Meryl Streep film. Because, you know, that's a film that I suppose on the surface presents Thatcher as a flawed person, as somebody who is kind of overly aggressive and who lets her visceral, you know, lust for power overwhelm her. But it's an incredibly sympathetic portrayal of Margaret Thatcher. I mean, it portrays her as world historic visionary leader. And it portrays the people who opposed her as, you know, empty mise-en-scene. I mean, apart from, I think, some stock footage at the beginning, when do any of the people who resisted Thatcher ever get to appear? It's like they appear as a faceless mob banging on the windows of her car, you know, when she drives through like Yorkshire or something. To me, if I had a criticism of the special relationship, it would be that it does something, you know, rather similar with Blair.
The Serbs call it ethnic cleansing.
Are you watching this?
Yes.
Okay, I'll tell my guys to tell NATO we're in.
It's not enough, Bill.
I'm here to ask you to commit to a ground invasion.
Until Milosevic does something, we do nothing.
Politically, I've really stuck my neck out here.
Why don't we step outside for a moment?
Those criticisms aside, I do think there is actually something quite advantageous in terms of what the thesis of this movie is. And also how it might be interpreted, that comes from having the Blair-Clinton relationship so central. Because, I mean, the personal relationships between politicians are ultimately, I mean, they very rarely tend to actually be all that important. Of course, they're endlessly written about in kind of Time magazine. And when hack books are written about, you know, political eras, it's these kinds of things that are always centered. I mean, I think you're right to point out, you pointed out earlier something that's kind of annoying about movies like this that are written sort of by and for political junkies, that there are all these lines where it's kind of like, oh, that's when they said the thing. Now we're getting to see it on the silver screen, you know, that kind of thing. All of that's a little bit annoying, and that, you know, that's kind of the, I mean, that is the mise-en-scene, that's the minutia of politics, that's not really the macro. But in this case, because the film is called The Special Relationship, and it is, I think, broadly speaking, trying to make some kind of a comment on the Anglo-American relationship, the fact that the personal kind of friendship and rivalry is so central, I actually think is very useful. Note the words Christopher Hitchens used in that passage I read earlier to describe the Anglo-American relationship, where he calls, you know, the history of the special relationship a mixed one of improvisation, secret diplomacy, covert action, inter-establishment jealousy, and military disaster. You know, the relationship of kind of sublimated rivalry and personal relations having kind of an outsized influence, Britain feeling at once junior and also smugly superior, America feeling incredibly self-assured, but then also weirdly unable to really think of itself as an empire, at least in kind of an official sense, which is not something you could have said about Britain in the 19th century. All of these things kind of find analogs in the relationship between Blair and Clinton in this movie. Blair is somebody who goes to meet with the American president, and before that just goes to learn from, you know, at the triangulation summer camp from you know, from the Democratic strategists, goes to learn how they win elections and just copies it. And he starts copying Clinton's personal style. Early in the film, is addressed as a kind of little brother by Bill Clinton, who speaks to him almost like a veteran coach would speak to like a rookie football player or something. And then later in the film, Blair tries to outgrow him. I think all of those dynamics actually are present in the Anglo-American relationship, not just politically, but also culturally as well. We haven't really had a chance to talk about, you know, I'll have to save this for another episode, but for example, the way that almost everything that comes from America is sort of treated as automatically cool in Britain, vice versa, I think it's a little more complicated. As a result, a lot of famous Brits will end up going to the United States and they're rarely as good ever again because they try to just copy American stuff and it doesn't really work. Did you ever see the Ricky Gervais episode of The Simpsons, by the way?
Yes, I did. I saw it when it aired. I was pretty near the peak of my Ricky Gervais fandom at the time, so I think I liked it then.
You did like it.
Perhaps I told myself I liked it. I mean, it feels like an episode of The Simpsons that has these strange freelance contributions by Ricky Gervais.
Yeah, that was my memory of it as well. I cannot recall what the plot was or anything else like that.
The thing is, back then, Ricky Gervais still seemed a little bit under the radar, a little bit obscure, so it kind of felt like, hey, we won. We got our guy on the board.
We'll have to do, one more kind of Ricky Gervais episode. Maybe for one of his really awful U.S. movies. Like, did you ever see... It probably wouldn't work for the show, but did you ever see Ghost Town?
That was what it was called, absolutely, right? Saw Ghost Town in a theater opening weekend. I'm sure the invention of lying could potentially work for the podcast because that's an atheist comedy.
I've never seen it. I remember you reviewed it. Was it for the Varsity?
Yeah, I gave it a somewhat lukewarm review, I think. That's a movie where it's like... It's an alternate reality where nobody has ever thought to lie and you find out that religion was created by the first man who had the idea to lie.
Oh my God, we have to do that. That sounds perfect.
My last comment on the movie is that all of these Peter Morgan movies and pretty much any biopic of a world leader or politician will have a scene where the world leader and his wife are in the bathroom and like the world leader's putting on his tie and they're brushing their teeth and they're saying something like, oh boy, that Bill sure seems like a dynamic leader, having very normal, ordinary conversations, or having conversations like at the breakfast table with their kids, and then they get a phone call where they're like, you better turn on the news, there's something going on.
Oh, right. Yeah, I love that, as if like the prime minister is going to be getting his news about like impeachment trials has started against President Clinton, like by an advisor calling him and saying, like Jonathan Powell called Tony Blair and said, quick, turn on CNN.
And I think it's perhaps possible that Tony Blair has pleasant conversations with his wife and children over the breakfast table. And yet somehow it doesn't seem possible. Somehow it just rings false every time I see it in a movie and it makes me cringe. I think perhaps instead they should set those scenes on Jeffrey Epstein's plane.
Speaking of which, I'll tell you what seemed really inauthentic to me was all the conversations between Bill and Hillary in this movie.
Oh man, how about that scene where they're in the backseat of the limo right after the Lewinsky scandal breaks?
Well, I was thinking of all the scenes where he has to kind of tell her with like increasing severity that, you know, something's going to break in the news. I'm about to testify, something did happen, et cetera, et cetera. And she's all kind of surprised.
That certainly is the official version of the story.
You're right. That is the official version.
Now watch this drive.
In our belief in progressive politics, we're united in our desire to see the values of progressive politics shape change. We're united in our determination that it is progressive politics, not the right wing, that should prepare our countries for the future. These past months have seen divisions over Iraq. But whatever those divisions, one thing we know, that for all the threats of terrorism and international security, the only true path to lasting peace is to be united also in recognizing that without those values of social justice, solidarity, opportunity, and security for all, there will never be lasting prosperity in our world, nor will it fully be at peace.
Which I make a great speech, and I'm dressed in white tie and tails. And I can tell you, I'm proud to have him as a friend, President Bill Clinton.
And one of the things that I think, by the way, that the Third Way ought to be doing is saying, let's stop fighting about the Iraq conflict. Saddam Hussein's gone. It's a good thing. Let's internationalize Iraq and beef up our truth presence in Afghanistan and not make the same mistake there we made 20 years ago. Right now, poor Mr. Karzai is the president of Kabul. World, China keeps taking manufacturing jobs in the United States and other places. So the people who say the answer is to let me run the world, who say, well, I'm going to get out of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, the Criminal Court, the Kyoto Treaty, I'm going to do just what I please, and we're going to move everything around to suit us. In the end, they can't win, because the only way the world can survive is to move toward cooperative integration. History is on our side.